Welcome to Federalist 2.0. This is a new podcast where we explore the ways in which the Constitution, our instruction manual for how to run a government, could be improved. I'm your host, Jeff, and you can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Now, on with the show. On today's episode, we're going to discuss the other parts of the legislature, what changes should be made to the Senate, and introduce the idea of a third legislative body. Buckle in, because Federalist 2.0 is getting frisky this week, guys. All right, so with the general structure of the House fleshed out, let's turn to the other existing legislative body, the Senate. One thing that the founders did correctly, in my opinion at least, is to view the senators as being representatives for the states. As the United States moved away from its federal origins and expanded the electorate, there was greater dissatisfaction with the way in which senators were put into power. And that unrest culminated in the 17th Amendment being ratified in 1938 that moved the senators into a popular vote arrangement instead of being appointed by the governors like they were before. I think, however, that this does damage to the original construct and concept of the Senate. Senators are supposed to be ambassadors of the states. They're there to support state interests. I believe one of the root causes of the dissatisfaction was the number and frequency of the senatorial seats. It's kind of absurd to think about the founding fathers deciding that two senators and six-year terms was the right approach to take. That very structure ensured that certain states had more consequential elections than others, depending solely on timing and sequencing. My guess is that the original decision to have 100 senators instead of 150 wasn't based on what they thought was right, but was really based on the Connecticut Compromise that we talked about in the last episode and trying to maintain this balance between small states and large states. The small states probably wouldn't go for a Senate that was smaller than 100, and the large states weren't going to go for a Senate that was larger than 100 because it gave disproportionate power in the presidential election. By greatly expanding the House, we sidestep this issue and need only concern ourselves now with the structure of the Senate. It's obvious to me that every governor should have the ability to appoint a senator every 2 years for a six-year term. This results in every gubernatorial election being equal in import and creates a cleanly revolving Senate with 150 members. If a governor is elected for a four-year term, they know they will appoint two senators. Each state still has the equal power in the Senate, which is very important, as we're about to see. Now, there will surely be some people that suggest that the bicameral structure should be eliminated altogether, that allowing small states to have equal say to large states in the crafting of laws is a relic of a bygone era, and that may be. That point has merit, though I may personally disagree with it. But it doesn't really matter because the one vestige of the 1787 Constitution that we're likely forever stuck with is the last sentence of Article 5. No state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. No amendment can change the nature of the Senate. You would need a state to allow for that to happen. That's why we must pick at the edges of this issue, capping the size of large states to encourage them to create smaller ones, increasing the size of the House to lessen the import of the Electoral College. These are goals that help to soften the edges of the system that are achievable within the construct. But let me take a step back and speak for a moment about what I see as the virtues of federalism. What's right for California will rarely be what's right for New York. The citizens of Kentucky and the citizens of Louisiana share very little in common. What's more, there's virtue in letting states experiment in different ways. If the national government arrives at a solution for a problem, it might be the best one, or it might be the second or third best one. It might be one of the worst decisions possible. Isn't it better to allow the states to arrive at their own solutions so that we can learn what the merits and demerits of any particular solution are? For sure, some things the states shouldn't have control over. States shouldn't be permitted to curtail basic rights, nor should they be permitted to influence contracts or trade in and between other states. They shouldn't be responsible for national defense or diplomacy. Broad economic policy should be taken care of nationally as well. the last thing anyone wants is to have to do some kind of currency exchange just to travel between Florida and Georgia. But for many, many other things, the states should be left mostly open to their own devices. The federal government should facilitate the sharing of information and maybe even establish broad goals and incentives for those goals. But rarely should the federal government be establishing policy on domestic issues that affect each state differently. Allow states to run themselves and allow the populace to vote with their feet as much as they want. The result will surely be some badly run states, no doubt. But the overall governance of America will be vastly improved. And when government does step in to right a wrong, like racially segregated schools, it will do so with clear and unequivocal moral authority. The line between federal and state governments should be clear, not muddy. It should be protected and cherished, not constantly eroded and chipped away at. And the responsibilities that are then incumbent on the states should be crystal clear as well. Make no mistake, some states will absolutely overreach. It's guaranteed to happen. They'll attempt to curtail rights or harm individual citizens, and the federal government has to stand ready to defend those individuals. Now, having spent the entire last section waxing poetic about states' rights, it seems like now is only an appropriate time to look at the constituency most underserved by the current political structure. That's that of the nation as a whole. While our current House has gotten away from being representative of the people, our proposed House fixes that issue, but it leaves a gulf. Who then is responsible for making decisions that affect the entire country? This part of my proposal will perhaps be viewed as the most controversial thus far, though I assure you there's much more to come. But I would propose the creation of a third legislative body. I'd call it the Parliament. I'm not attached to that name, and there's no reason this Parliament needs to resemble in form or function the type of system that's regularly seen in European governance. But it should be a deliberative body elected nationally and serving national interests. The size is an open question. What I envision is a relatively small body, large enough to support multiple views and parties, but small enough to reach consensus relatively easily. Something like one person per 2 million would work. Really, the size could grow logarithmically, or even it could be fixed. The important part is it's structured to address the needs of the nation as a whole. And that requires thought on the structure of how it's created and formed. I would suggest, personally, that Parliament should be out of sync with the elections of the executive. Something like every fourth year in the off-election years would work fine. So 2000, 2004, 2008 are presidential election years. 2002, 2006, 2010 are parliamentary years. Each party would put up an ordered list of representatives. The voters would then vote for their legislative party of choice, and the seats would be assigned proportionally in order as they go down that list. As this is a representative democracy, voters should still have an ability to refuse representation by certain individuals, lest the party become stacked with cronies or seats be given out as political favors. So to accommodate this, the voters should have the ability to refuse individual representatives from the slate provided by the party. And if a majority agree, that individual is just skipped when the parliamentary seats are determined. This wouldn't happen very frequently, but I think it's a very important safety valve to have when crafting a parliament like this. So far, we've discussed the potential benefits of the tricameral system and what constituencies it might serve, but the real details will come down to the powers that those various chambers have. How do we dole out the existing constitutional powers? Are there any new powers that are needed? And how, with all this insanity, does legislation actually get done? All that and more on the next episode of Federalist 2.0. Thanks again for listening to another episode of Federalist 2.0. My name is Jeff. You can reach me at federalistreboot@gmail.com. Please remember to like and subscribe. Apparently, giving 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts really helps, so if you're using that service, please do that. And until next time, thank you and goodbye.